I believe the Spirit has given me a word of prophecy that everybody needs to hear. So, okay, it has to do with businessmen in Greenville.
Yeah.
I think the church needs to do a better job of equipping businessmen to work
in the
offices.
I think I have a word of knowledge.
What? A word of knowledge?
A word of knowledge.
Okay, okay.
Prophecy.
Everybody, I wrote a new song! It's the song God gave me! Listen up!
You are faithful.
When is the other one?
Brothers and sisters, when you come together for worship, and one of you has a hymn, and one of you has a word of wisdom, a word of instruction, a word of knowledge, one of you has a revelation, another speaks in a tongue that we didn't understand. I'm still waiting on the interpretation for that. But when you come together, make sure that what you do, you come together to build each other up. If any speak in a tongue, let there only be two or three at most, and each in turn, and let someone interpret. And if there is no interpreter, then you should keep silent in the church and speak privately to yourself and to God. Let there be two or three prophets who speak, and let the others weigh what is said. If a revelation is made to one sitting there, then the one who is speaking should yield the floor and let the other speak, so that all may learn and be encouraged. You can all prophesy one by one. But God is not a God of confusion. He is a God of peace. And that's the way it is in all the churches of the saints. Now, the women are to keep silent in the churches. We'll dig into this in a minute. Just hold on. They're not permitted to speak, but they should be subject, as the law says. And if a woman has any questions, she needs to ask her husband later on at home. Or it's shameful for a woman to speak in such a disruptive way in a church meeting. Now, I know you think that you pride yourself on your giftedness and your spirituality, but you've got to realize the Word of God, it didn't just come from you. It didn't come to you, reach you, and like you're the only one. But if anyone thinks he's a prophet or anyone thinks he's spiritual, he should acknowledge that the things that I'm writing to you are a command from the Lord. If anyone doesn't recognize what I'm saying, what I'm writing here, he's not to be recognized in the assembly. So yes, brothers and sisters, earnestly desire spiritual gifts. Earnestly desire to prophesy. And don't forbid speaking in tongues. But let all things be done decently and in order. Now, how many of you are scared half to death when Jonathan stood up with a word of prophecy this morning? Yep. Now, that's pretty chaotic. If you're a first-timer here this morning, we don't do this kind of thing every week. But we did it this morning because we're in a study in the book of 1 Corinthians, our theme being what a gospel-shaped community looks like. And specifically, we're looking at what a gospel-shaped community looks like when it comes to worship. And that little reenactment there may give us some insight into what a Sunday gathering in the Corinthian church may have been like. People speaking over each other, asking questions, questioning each other. Everyone speaking and singing at the same time. And the service was just out of control. It was just full of chaos and confusion. And hopefully you can better see how the text that I just read speaks directly to a specific problem in that church. I mean, this is one of those texts of Scripture that seems very foreign to us. And we don't have the same kind of problems in our church that they had in theirs. But what the Apostle Paul is doing here in chapter 14, verses 26 through 40, is he's finishing up a discussion that he started way back in chapter 11, a discussion about problems that were disrupting public worship. Chapter 11, he began by speaking about some problem women in the church who were praying and prophesying without having their heads covered. And that was considered to be immodest in that day, a sign of disrespect for the husbands. And then he went on to talk about problems concerning the Lord's Supper, how the Lord's Supper was being observed. It was in such unloving ways amongst the members. And then in chapters 12 through 14, he's been dealing with problems regarding spiritual gifts. And the presenting problem is that there were people in the church who spoke in tongues, and they considered themselves to be more spiritual than everybody else. And then there were a group that had the gift of prophecy, and the prophets looked at themselves like they were the defining leadership in the church, and so what they had to say was more important than everybody else. But what we need to get our minds around is that Paul ends this whole discussion on problems that are disrupting public worship by giving us some insights into what is supposed to happen as we gather for worship. Now, he's not writing a worship manual here. He's not laying down hard and fast rules for all time and all places. Remember, he's writing to correct a specific problem. And while Paul doesn't tell us everything that could be or should be said about worship, he does give us some broad, general principles about what a gospel-shaped community looks like and feels like when it gathers for worship. And these basic principles, I think, are very clear. Even though some of the specific things, when we get down to the details and the interpretation of details, they're not so clear. But the big things are clear. Now, the first principle that he lays down, we're going to have to back up, I think. We're going to back up to verse 24. Because in verse 24, I think he lays down what I would say would be the goal of worship. It's something we touched on last week, but I want to explore a bit more in detail this week. He says, if in your church gatherings, people prophesy, and we said last week that prophecy is the spontaneous, spirit-inspired speaking in a language that everybody can understand, that encourages and comforts and strengthens and directs and corrects and warns. So if people are speaking clear, spirit-inspired messages in your gatherings, he says, and an unbeliever or someone who doesn't understand comes in, it says there's a good chance he'll be convicted by all, called to account by all, and the secrets of his heart will be disclosed. And he'll fall down and worship God, declaring that God is really among you. In other words, the goal of worship is to experience God, is to encounter God. That's what Paul wanted for them, but it wasn't happening because in the exercise of their spiritual gifts, specifically these two gifts of tongues and prophecy, they were not acting in loving ways with each other. They weren't coming to church on Sunday, the church meeting, to experience God so much as they were coming to have their own private little spiritual experience for themselves, and there is a difference. Think about it. Different people come to worship for different reasons, right? I mean, think, why did you come to worship this morning? Well, you say, well, because I do it pretty much every Sunday morning. I might skip to go to the lake every now and then, but it's a habit. Or you might come because you like to have your kids in youth group or children's ministry. Okay, let's shoot for something a little higher. Seems to me that many people come to church. One reason is to hear the Bible taught. They come to learn something. They want to be instructed. And so it's kind of like a Bible class. And that's not, I'm glad for that. But it's not the main reason. Other people, I think, might come not necessarily to learn something, but to feel something. They come for more inspiration than information. They're caught up in the music and the atmosphere, which, like good Bible teaching, points us to God, but still, our reason for meeting together, it needs to be more than simply what I get out of a service, whether it's information or inspiration or a little bit of both. Now, we come to encounter God, and so the music and the message are the means to an end. They're not the end. We need to be clear on that. Now, if I'm reading verse 25 correctly, Paul seems to be saying that the focus as we gather should be on God Himself, on being open for God to speak into our lives. And I realize that this passage is speaking specifically to what happens in an unbeliever's life, but it does seem to me that if God can speak this deeply into the life of an unbeliever, then surely He can speak this deeply into the life of someone who does know Him. The words "fall down" catch my attention, because here's someone who shows up at church and they have a real encounter with God, but they didn't expect it. They didn't expect it, but they come in and fall down and worship. Now, there are plenty of churches where people come expecting to fall down on Sunday. And I'm not poking fun at these churches. I mean, Episcopal churches, they kneel down. In churches like ours, we stand, we raise our hands. Some churches, in Pentecostal churches, they come expecting to fall down. Now, what grabs my attention here, though, this person he's talking about, these people, they don't come expecting to meet God, but they do. Now, what they don't come expecting to meet God, but the text tells me we should come expecting to meet God. Because there's a picture painted for us as to what can happen. And when God shows up, there's three things He says that can happen. People are convicted by what they hear in Spirit-inspired messages and from what they see and hear among a Spirit-embodied people. And as a result, they're called to account for their sin. That is, they have to admit that what God has revealed about them is true. And then it says, the secrets of their heart are disclosed. Now, that catches my attention, too, because what that means, it means that when God shows up, you see something in your heart that you haven't seen before. And so this is one of the ways you know that you've come into the presence of God. We're not simply talking about getting information. We're not simply talking about inspiration. We're talking about invasion. God suddenly, unexpectedly shows up, opens the eyes of your heart. You see your life in a whole different way. You see motives that have been unloving instead of God honoring. You see yourself as being self-seeking. You see what you've been trying so hard all of your life to hide. It's Spirit-inspired revelation that creates the kind of worship environment that cuts to the heart. Look at verse 25 again. He says, when God shows up, people fall down and worship. Simultaneously, you see who you are and you see who God is. And you see who you are as someone who's in a desperate strait. You admit your sin, and you not only see the justice and the holiness of God, but you see the greatness of God and the grace of God and the cross of Christ, and you fall down and you worship. And one of the things that comes out of a time like this is not only do you realize that God is here, but you also realize that God's always been there. He's always known those secrets. My Hebrew professor at Dallas Seminary tells a story about how God revealed the secrets of His heart to him. He was in a small group meeting, and there was a man who was a stranger to the group that came one night, and he had the gift of prophecy, and the man looked at him and made one simple statement to him. He said, "Your father dropped the ball on you, didn't he?" Again, this was the first meeting, and there was no way this man could have known that this was the most sensitive issue in my professor's heart. It's true, his father had dropped the ball on him and his whole family of six, because when he was 12 years old, his father had committed suicide. And he said that the shock and the hurt caused a pool of spiritual acid in his 12-year-old heart, and because he was so hurt, he determined he would be strong and he would never need anyone again. Now, I'm going to read you part of his story. Because he talks about how he was a pretty rebellious, reckless teenager, but when he was 17, he trusted Christ. He put all the reckless stuff behind him, but coming to Christ didn't heal immediately that reservoir of bitterness at the bottom of his heart. He writes, "Nobody ever told me about bitterness or about the anger born of bitterness and how it was behind my rebellious teen years and immorality. Nobody ever told me that even after you become a Christian, bitterness doesn't go away automatically. Nobody ever told me that bitterness hidden in your heart can make you skeptical of the goodness of others and the goodness of God. Nobody ever told me that bitterness can make you afraid to love too much for fear that you'll be cheated again. Nobody ever told me that if you leave bitterness alone, it will integrate itself so perfectly into your personality that you won't know that it's there. And you'll end up dealing with the symptoms of your anger and harshness, but never know their cause. Now, people had told me that the sins of your youth come back to haunt you. But nobody ever told me that bitterness, the bitterness of your youth, can hound you all the way to your grave. Nobody told me any of this. So by the time I was 38, Jesus decided it was time he told me. And he told him through a man with the gift of prophecy, who felt the Spirit prompting him just to ask one simple question. Your father dropped the ball on you, didn't he? And with that, the secrets of his heart were exposed, and something that had been wrong for so many years was made right. Here's how he concludes the story. He says, through the words of that prophet, God's healing love came to me, reinterpreting my past, my present, my future. God told the prophet about my pain because God wanted me to know he had always been there. Always. I guess the question, do we expect God to show up in ways like that? Do we expect God to show up either in what is spoken in a Sunday meeting or what is shared in a community group? Do we expect God to speak through a friend to us like that? Do we expect God to speak through a stranger to us like that? You say, well, I don't know, that sounds a little bit too charismatic for my taste. Are you sure you want to go there? Are you sure you want to write anything and everything like this off to something charismatic as if the fallback position, and that's the fallback position of your Christian life, and in falling back to that position, you just live in a purely natural way? The fact is, charismatic churches are the fastest growing kind of evangelical church in the world. Now, as you'll see in a moment, I don't agree with everything that goes on in those churches, but I'll tell you what I do agree with, is in those churches, the ones that I've visited and the ones that I've been to, people show up expecting God to meet with them. They look for him. They long for him. They expect him to show up and do something. I know some of them show up and they want to have their own little private spiritual experience, just like some of us. And just like these Corinthians, but there's an atmosphere, there's an attitude that God in a room with people who expect God to show up that says, God is here today and he could really make himself known this morning and our lives could be changed forever right here, right now. I think that's what Paul wants the Corinthians to experience. That's what he wants them to live and breathe. An encounter with God, not just information, not just inspiration, but an invasion of God. And he wants them to come into their gatherings expecting to encounter God in a personal, powerful way. Did you come that way this morning? That's the question, isn't it? That's why we gather. Now, he talks a little bit about how we gather. In verse 26, he says, brothers, sisters, when you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. First, hear this correctly. Again, Paul's not describing everything that could or should be done in a worship service. I mean, this can't be a complete list of what was going on in the church. He doesn't mention anything about the Lord's Supper here. He doesn't mention anything about the public reading of Scripture that he exhorted Timothy to make sure was a part of a worship service. His point, though, is that there's a variety of things that can happen in and through people when they come to worship. First, they come to encounter God. Second, and we talked about this last week, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but secondly, they come eagerly desiring that God would speak to them and through them so other people can be built up. Anytime the church gathers, whether it's large meeting or small meeting, Sunday service, community groups in homes, men's, women's Bible studies, you come not just for information, not just for a bit of inspiration to carry you through the week. You come eagerly desiring for God to speak to you and through you into other people's lives for the purpose of encouraging them, comforting them, strengthening them, maybe even speaking something that God's popped into your head and said, I don't know if this means anything, but let me just... That's what he's talking about here. There's something spirit-prompted going on. You might come into a community group with a hymn to share. You might not feel comfortable singing it, but you might turn to an Old Testament psalm and say, this meant a lot to me this past week. You might come with a word of instruction. There's been something that God has previously taught you, and you want to share that. You might come with a revelation. Like you're like right in the middle of the meeting, you say, well, I don't know if this means anything, but let me just share this. This might be something the Spirit wants us to hear. And so there's this, there's worship and teaching and Spirit-prompted sharing. And these things, we tried to build these kinds of things into our large group gatherings. But in meetings this large, it's hard to allow for the kind of spontaneity that Paul is talking about here without scaring everybody half to death like we did at the beginning of the service. Or confusing people that come in and they don't understand Christianese and what's going on. And as we'll see, that's very important. I mean, you got to remember the Corinthian church was just 20, 30 people meeting in somebody's home, more like a community group. And in fact, I would encourage community groups, you need to make your group a place for mutual ministry like this, where this kind of one anothering can take place, where you're speaking into each other's lives and you're preparing your hearts to go to those meetings by saying, God, as I go to this meeting, I'm open. If you want to speak to me and through me to somebody else, here I am. Send me. Speak to me. That's the positive side. That as we gather, we come together to encounter God. We come together eagerly desiring that God would speak to us so that we can encourage and strengthen and comfort others. But there's something else that Paul considers equally as important. In verses 27 to 35, he talks about eliminating distractions. He's not giving us an order of service, but he does say that there should be order in the service. Paul knows that when the church gathers, verse 24 and 25, back to that again, you will have a wide range of people at different places on their spiritual journey in your church. You're going to have mature believers. You'll have immature believers. You'll have new believers. You'll have unbelievers, skeptics and seekers. And he's saying that everything needs to be done so that believers are built up in their faith and unbelievers can be brought to faith. And in these verses, he deals with problem tongue speakers and problem prophets and problem women. All right? It's like he's saying, I know it sounds foreign to us, maybe in the details, but not in the general principle. Stay with me. It's like he's saying, if you want different people at different stages of spiritual growth to encounter God, you got to think about not just yourself, but you got to think about everybody around you. So, verses 27 to 30, he says to the problem tongue speakers, if anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be only two, at most three, and each in turn, and let someone interpret. But if there's no one to interpret, let each of them keep silent in the church meeting and speak privately to God. So he's saying, in order to create an environment that will reach the widest possible audience, he says, even though the Spirit might be moving in your heart to speak to God in a tongue, he says, don't pray out loud unless you know that there's a person with a known gift of interpretation present. And even then, he says, only two, at most three. And don't all of you speak at the same time, speak one at a time. And you see, he's saying, just because you feel the Spirit's moving in you doesn't mean you have to blurt out everything you think the Spirit's telling you. He's saying, get control of yourself. Surprisingly enough, in many churches that practice speaking in tongues in the worship service, the norm is to totally ignore the guidelines in this passage. the norm is for everyone to speak in tongues, when chapter 12, verse 30 says that implies that not everybody has the gift of tongues. The norm is for everyone to speak in tongues at the same time and for there to be no interpretation. They don't follow the guidelines. And the guidelines weren't being followed in Corinth because the problem people were more concerned with building up their own ego than building up each other. He goes on to speak to problem prophets who kind of doing the same kind of thing as the problem tongue speakers. I mean, someone would be sharing something the Spirit had impressed on their mind, and before he was finished, somebody else would be going, oh, I got something to say, and they would stand up and start blurting it out. Paul says, brothers and sisters, that's not agape. He says, let two or three prophets speak, and let the other prophets weigh what is said. In other words, other prophets need to agree that what was said has truly come from God, is in sync with the written word that they had, and the apostolic doctrine and traditions that were being circulated among the churches. He says, let two or three prophets speak, and let the others weigh what is said. And if a revelation is made to someone sitting there, let the first, the one who was speaking, let him keep silent. Be silent, for you can all prophesy one by one so that all may learn and be encouraged. The spirit of the prophets are subject to the prophets. For God is not a God of confusion. God is God of peace. And that is true in all the churches of the saints. Pretty much the same guidelines. Two or three can speak, not all at the same time, but one at a time. And if someone is speaking, and the one sitting next to him says, you know, he tugs on your toga and says, I got something to say. You go, okay, brother. And you sit down and you yield the floor to him. And he says, you know, everybody will have a chance to share. Maybe not this week. I mean, if you're the fourth or fifth person and only two or three could share, you got to wait till next week. But that's not quenching the Spirit, according to what Paul says here. You don't quench the Spirit by maintaining order in your meeting. I tell you, when you think about this, one of the most unspiritual sounding things in the whole discussion, it's like he's saying, I don't care how you feel. I don't care what you think that God might be saying to you. Only two or three of you can share one by one. The message has to be clear and needs to be understood by all. He says you can control yourself. Just because you're under the control of the Spirit doesn't mean that the Spirit doesn't give you self-control. Because the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, and gentleness, goodness, and faithfulness, self-control. I wasn't speaking in a tongue there. He says, verse 32, the subject, that the spirit of the prophet is subject to the prophets. What that mean? It means if you have the gift of prophecy, if the Spirit makes something known to you, you still have control over yourself. And it also probably means that you must submit yourself to the other prophets in the room. Why? Verse 33. Here's the reason why. It's so important to follow these principles that eliminate distractions, because God is a God of peace, not of confusion. And that's the way it is in all the churches of the saints, he says. You're no exception, implied. This is an important verse because it tells us that what happens in a worship service tells us something about the very nature of God. That God is a God of peace and order, not of chaos and confusion. And the law, the Torah, makes that clear. Genesis 1, God brings order out of chaos. The whole Old Testament Mosaic law was all about bringing order to the people of God, which was very different from the chaos and confusion in the surrounding pagan culture. So, yes, if the Spirit is moving in your meetings, there is going to be spontaneity. But, he says, spontaneity is to be tempered by structure. Order trumps disorder. And so as you gather, large groups, small groups, create environments where mature believers and new believers and baby Christians and skeptics and seekers can all, verse 31, all learn and be encouraged, free from distraction. Now there's one more group that is a problem group, and that's the problem women. The women should keep silent in the churches, he says in verse 34, for they're not permitted to speak, but they should be in submission, as the law also says. as the law also says. If there is anything that they desire to learn, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in a church meeting. Now we really sound foreign and distant from the biblical text, don't we? And these verses have been the center of controversy and debate for a long time. And admittedly, as the verses lay there on the page, it really does sound like Paul's giving a blanket prohibition that in a church meeting, whether large or small, women should keep their mouths shut. Verse 34, women are to keep silent in the church. They are not permitted to speak. Seems pretty cut and dry. However, if you read the verses in context, if you take into account some of the other things that Paul says in the surrounding context, you realize he can't mean what it sounds like he's saying. Because if you pull away and see through the words on the page to the big ideas of the passage in context, like we talked about last week, a different picture begins to emerge. Now, that's true. He does say that women should keep silent, not speak in public worship. But in the larger context, remember chapters 11 to 14, the larger context is about problems in public worship. And back in chapter 11, verses 5 and 6, he says that there were certain women who were praying out loud in the services and prophesying, meaning that they were delivering, they were speaking spontaneous, spirit-inspired messages from God to encourage and strengthen and comfort just like the men. Chapter 11, women are speaking in the gatherings. And Paul doesn't have a problem with that. What Paul has a problem with is that these women, Christian women, in their newfound freedom in Christ, they're going, we don't have to wear head coverings anymore. That was customary in that day. That for a woman not to wear a head covering was considered to be immodest. And if she was married, it was considered to be immodest and disrespectful to her husband. So in the larger context, dealing with the problems in public worship, he doesn't have a problem with women speaking, praying and prophesying in public worship. So whatever he's saying in chapter 14 cannot mean that women should never speak in church under any circumstances. Now that fits with the immediate context, because this is the third time that Paul has told a group of people to keep silent in a church meeting. Did you notice it? Verse 28, he told problem tongue speakers to keep silent if there was no interpretation. In verse 30, he told problem prophets to yield the floor and keep silent. Someone else had something to share. So the word silent, sagato in the Greek, doesn't mean keep silent at all times and in every circumstance. It means keep silent, and that is governed by the context. And so here in verse 34, he uses the same word, keep silent, when he addresses problem women in the church. And again, interestingly enough, this section forms a bookend, because he started in chapter 11 by talking about problem women not wearing head coverings, and now he's talking about problem women. Well, what is the issue in chapter 14? That's really where the debate comes in. But here's how I see it. The context of this passage tells me that there was chaos and confusion and disorder when the Corinthians met together for worship. People were inconsiderate, speaking over each other, blurting out whatever they felt like the Spirit was moving them to say. They were out of control. And so as I see it in verses 34 and 35, Paul addresses another problem of the same kind. There was some kind of problem where women were interrupting, disrupting the service. Could very well be he's talking about wives. It's not about being submissive to their husband. I'll get to that in a minute. It's more about, could have been wives who, and women in that day were not educated. They were not schooled. It could very well be that the women were asking their husbands, what is he saying? What does that mean? What's that? I can't understand what's going on. And so they may be talking to their husbands back and forth. That's why that may be occurring. That's why he says, if they got questions, let them ask their husbands at home. And he better have been in a men's Bible study, because he's going to be the one that has to answer the questions. Could be something like that, but whatever it is, it's this disruptive. Women could be participating in the evaluating of what the prophets are saying, maybe even what their husbands are saying. And they're going, well, I'll tell you what he's like at home. You tell me, you know. And whatever they're doing, he says, is shameful. Same word he used back in chapter 11. And so he says they should be, that these problem women are not allowed to speak in a disruptive way. He says they have to be in submission as the law says. The law being the Torah, the Hebrew Bible. He's not talking about being submissive to husbands. We bring that into the context. He's talking about being submissive to the principle of order. That God is a God of order. And God is of peace. And so when he says, as the law says, as I said early, he's referring to Genesis 1. And that a worship service is to be a place of order. But whatever these problem women are doing, interrupting, asking questions of their husbands out loud because they don't understand, not agreeing with what the prophets are saying, whatever they're doing is disrupting the service, and he says they need to stop it and submit to the principle of order in the assembly, that they are to ask their husbands at home. So he's saying eliminate distractions so that people can be built up and encounter God. So he sums up everything in 36 to 40, and he hits hard the Corinthian arrogance he's been dealing with in every chapter of this book. He says, I'm going to add some words, paraphrase, verse 36. You think you're so spiritual. Was it from you that the word of God came, or are you the only ones it has reached? Hear me. If anyone thinks he's a prophet or spiritual, he should acknowledge the things that I'm writing to you are the command of the Lord. In other words, apostle trumps prophet, hands down. And if anyone doesn't recognize what I'm telling you here, he's not to be recognized as spiritual, much less a prophet. So, here's my conclusion on the matter, brothers and sisters. Yes, absolutely, earnestly desire spiritual gifts. Earnestly desire prophecy. And do not forbid speaking in tongues, but make sure all things are done decently and in order. So how does all this apply to us? Let me suggest two things. Over the years, I've had a lot of people say, you know, I wish we had more time for worship. It's just sometimes, some mornings, we're just kind of getting into it. And then we have to stop. Now, I understand that. But if I'm reading the text correctly, I think there's going to always be a tension between spontaneity and structure. On the one hand, we've got to be open and expectant for God to show up and do something unexpected, spontaneously. But he says, on the other hand, there are other things to consider. Like, I try to speak no longer than 40 minutes. Now, is that quenching the spirit? I don't think so. I mean, because I have to be considerate of your time. I have to be considerate of Matt's time. I have to be considerate of the people in the nursery and the children. And people like to know when the end of the service is. I mean, it's not quenching the spirit to say we have to begin and end at a certain time. Matt tries to organize the rest of the service in the remaining 35 minutes, allowing for time for reading the scripture and for varieties of things, like having different people share. Matt does such a great job at creating variety in the service, but then the bulk of it is exalting God in what we sing, exalting the gospel and the cross. But there's a time limit. Is that quenching the spirit? No. You say, how can you be so sure? Verse 40. Make sure all things are done decently in order. It's not quenching the spirit. If I'm reading the passage correctly, there's always going to be some tension between spirit-prompted spontaneity and self-imposed structure. Why? In order to reach the widest range of people, so that everyone can learn and be encouraged, so that our great God is seen by all to be a God of order and a God of peace, because he can bring order and peace into chaotic lives. A lot of truth rests in the tension between spontaneity and structure. Second thing, I want to encourage you to begin, if you don't do this already, to begin spending time to prepare your heart for coming to worship and community gatherings. That can be something as simple as when you lay your head on the pillow Saturday night, you ask the Spirit to show up in our gatherings in life-changing ways. Ask the Spirit to change people's lives tomorrow as we gather for worship or in community group. Invite the Spirit to speak to you so that you might, and through you, so that you can build other people up, that you might have a word of encouragement to somebody who's going through the fire. Ask the Spirit, invite the Spirit. Here I am. Speak to me, through me, to others. Offer yourself to the Spirit. Tell Him you really want to be changed yourself. Tell the Spirit, here, I need my heart rearranged. I know there's secrets down there that need to be brought to light. I know there's things in me that need to be exposed so I can be free. So when I go to this meeting, here I am. Do in me whatever you need to do to make me more the man, the husband, the father, the woman, the wife, the mother that I need to be. And not only you do that, but lead your family to do that if you're married or you have kids. Talk to your family about what it means to come to worship, expecting to meet God and expecting and desiring to minister to other people. Help us create environments where people can encounter God in personal and powerful ways. And help us eliminate distractions. Get in trouble. We don't have problems with tongue speakers and problem prophets or problem women. We have problem with people coming into the service late and leaving early. I don't know if you know how distracting that can be to the worship team when they get up and 40 or 50 people get up and leave. It can be very distracting. Now, I know a lot of you have to go early to work in children's ministry or cafe team or commons area or something like that. But we have to think about this as well. How can you help eliminate distractions to create an environment where people can encounter God? Where people can speak into each other's life. Because you see, you might want to beat the traffic and beat the crowd to Salsaritas or wherever. But it might be in the very last moment of the service that God has somebody grab you by the arm and say, "How you doing?" Or He has you grab somebody by the arm and say, "Tell me what's happened since the last time we talked." And a God moment could happen right there. Begin and we end. We have to begin and end. We have to have structure. Don't cut God out of the equation. Like, it's coming when you want and leaving when you want. Now, I know nobody's going to leave now. Father, thank you for giving us such clear words. Even in the things we don't understand, there's so much we can understand that if you, Spirit, take it and apply it to our hearts, we will be different people. And that is our desire, that we be the people, the individuals, the people, the church you want us to be for your greater fame and your greater glory. Jesus, we pray.